this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We're going to deny you the fruits of your labor and tell you the reason why you can't get the fruits of your labor is because of another black or brown Latino person coming here, and so you need to be mad at them versus being mad at the people who are truly holding the purse.
Attorney Adante Poynter on immigration raids and Trump's civil rights rollbacks.
We've lost everything, and we need some help. I'm asking J.D. Vance and Trump to come help East Palestine.
Residents of East Palestine, Ohio, poisoned and contaminated by the Norfolk Southern train derailment 2 years ago, are still waiting for justice, health care, and funds to move out of contaminated homes.
It was over 100,000 batteries caught on fire. And you can't put those fires out. You just have to let them burn.
Lithium battery storage plants around the country are prone to fires that threaten workers and communities.
You see, while Louis Armstrong is arriving in the Congo, they're plotting the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And he's the first democratically elected premier. But what Malcolm X says is that, you know, it's not communism or socialism they're afraid of, it's Africanism. It's people standing up for their own right and choosing that the riches of the country would benefit the population.
And we hear from the director of Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, a new documentary that looks at the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Attorney Adante Poynter is with Lawyers for the People. He spoke to J.R. Val Ray about the recent ICE, that is Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids, taking place around the country and how the bounties put on the heads of undocumented immigrants are similar to the ones put on the heads of runaway slaves in the past. Poynter also talked about Trump's civil rights rollbacks, as well as his attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
First thing hitting the news really hard since Trump took office has been immigration. What are your thoughts on how ICE is basically abducting people and saying that they're criminals, if they're illegal? I mean, that may be questionable, but what are your thoughts on Trump's first days in office?
You know, it's wide ranging of executive orders that essentially codify and state what he had been talking about on the campaign trail. So one thing about Trump, he told you what he was going to do, and now he's doing it. And if anybody was paying attention to essentially his manifesto or his playbook, which was the 2025 book of orders and policies, then he's following that to the T. And so he made immigration a big plank of his campaign, and he's following through, which is amazing that so many people whose communities are directly affected by immigration, which is essentially everybody, and they voted for a person who said that he's going to export and essentially declare and treat people as illegal aliens and not as humans, not as citizens, not as people who he might want to repatriate, not as people whose lines have crossed over their native homeland, not as people whose political line and statehoods have been cut off or essentially abducted from them and taken from them are now considered illegal because they're not documented by the current political system, but yet have been exploited by the current political system, either as a source of labor here in this country and or destabilize their countries abroad so that it created a political and economic crisis that attracted them to the United States in order to feed the United States hunger for labor, cheap labor at that. So, you know, what you see going on with these ICE raids and what they're doing, they've essentially deputized not only ICE, but the DEA, as well as FBI and other alphabet agencies within the federal government to have police powers to be able to go into people's homes, into their churches, into their schools, into the community, and as you said, abduct people off the streets because maybe their paperwork isn't up to date, or they've been waiting to get a response on their application that's pending, or they thought that they would have birthright citizenship that's been enshrined in the Constitution that he's seeking to overturn and eradicate. And this has thrown the country in an upheaval because the not so much of a secret is that these people that he's classified as illegal aliens are the people who are now forming the backbone of our agricultural industries and or doing jobs that other Americans don't want to do. It's not that they're here doing the jobs or taking jobs from people that don't want to do the work. A lot of the work that they're doing, the backbreaking work, is things that people themselves here already in the States don't want to do. And so it's further dividing the proletariat or the working class people amongst ourselves, because what he did, he hung immigration out as a bait to say, look, you want to know, black folks, you want to know why you don't have jobs? You want to know why you don't have resources? It's because these group of people are taking them from you. When in actuality, if you can give immigrants or people who come over here $750 or housing or food vouchers, but then you could send on a voice vote every year $6 billion or $1 trillion to Israel, or you could send $600 million to Ukraine on a voice vote in the Congress without there being a debate, then clearly you have the amount of money and the resources to deal with your people here at home. But instead of it being framed in that way, it's in a classic kind of us versus them zero-sum game. It's you here in America who've been exploited and ignored and denied the benefits of your return on investment from hundreds of years of providing free or close to free labor, be it, you know, through the slavery or indentured servitude or even through the prison system. We're going to deny you the fruits of your labor and tell you the reason why you can't get the fruits of your labor is because of another black or brown Latino person coming here. And so you need to be mad at them versus being mad at the people who are truly holding the purse.
Right. Now, I've seen that in some states, they are trying to give away money to help ICE locate undocumented peoples. Is that what you're seeing? And is that legal?
What's legal doesn't mean it's right. And so
that's right. That's
what you
right.
see going on is, yes, they're putting essentially a bounty on people's heads, which it's very similar, if you understand your history, is the same type of bounty system that they put on Native Americans, that they put on, quote unquote, escaped slaves throughout our history. Whereas once they designate a group of people as being so valuable that the government will put money upon or give reward people for turning them into the government, then you now become the hunted. You now become the prey. And so that's what you're seeing going on now. And I think I've read it's like $750 per person. So they've created a big financial incentive for folks to turn in people who are considered to be illegal. So, you know, this is to me akin to, as I said, a bounty system that we've seen set up throughout American history.
Can you talk about the recent attacks on DEI, most prominently the attack on civil rights investigations? Can you talk a little bit about Trump's executive orders that went in that direction?
Yes, within not the following days, but literally on the first day of he took office and was sworn in, during one of his inauguration speeches, he had a desk set up and he had several executive orders already written, and he signed them in front of his supporters who gathered for his inauguration. And he signed several. But the two you're mentioning is one was to essentially overturn and get rid of the executive orders that were put in place for equal protection clauses that would allow the government, our federal government, to essentially hire what had been marginalized people. So you're talking about minorities or majorities. You're talking about African Americans, and put in place what they call so-called affirmative action, which was to address the historical discrimination and exclusion of African Americans from the federal government, in particular getting jobs, as well as for qualifying for different employment opportunities as relates to businesses and contracting. And if anyone's ever been to Washington, D.C., or if you take a look, much of the federal government was used to build the black middle class because private industry was discriminating against black folks. And so what he essentially did by eradicating that, he's undermining a huge economic foundation that has been used to create the black middle class. So it's not just the jobs. It's actually the development opportunities for black business, be it in contracting, be it in construction, being in other types of forms of businesses he's doing away with. And that's one of those executive orders he signed on the first day within hours of taking office. The other one that you mentioned is around what's going on, what you see at the Department of Justice. And that is Trump saying, look, what we're going to do now, we're going to build upon the platform he had during his first term, which was to discourage and to not put in place these consent decrees that govern police departments who, after being investigated, are shown to engage in a pattern and practice of discriminating against Black folks and other Latinos and Black and brown people. And on his first day in office, he said, we are suspending, we are freezing any new litigation by the Department of Justice as it relates to investigating discrimination by police departments. And any such reforms or consent decrees that were put in place to make sure that policing is done constitutionally, that were done within the last 90 days, we're not even going to honor those. And so what he's attempting to do is, in my opinion, to make good on his campaign promises, where he talked about all officers need to be granted qualified immunity, which, for those of your listeners who don't understand, that's essentially saying that we're going to let officers engage in all manner sorts of discriminatory, abusive behavior, and we're not going to allow them to be held accountable to the court system. Instead, we're going to grant them immunity for their actions, and we're going to let those who are suffered, those who have been victimized, hell, you're just going to have to go home to your community and deal with it. And so he's trying to make good on that campaign promise, and that's the first step. And what he's also done at the Department of Justice is he's focused in on this whole deep state. You've heard many people who watch the campaign and follow the campaigns heard him talk about that. Well, what he's done, he's removed many veteran prosecutors within the Department of Justice, and he's reclassified them or transferred them from dealing with civil rights cases around police or civil rights cases around the environment, and he sent them to a newly established working group that his administration has set up as it relates to making sure that sanctuary cities work with ICE to get rid of people who they want to deport. And so it's akin to a victim being forced to do the victimizing of people and say, if you're unwilling to hold the lash of the slave owner and lash your former or fellow slaves or people who are oppressed, then you can no longer work for the massa. So he's saying, if you don't want to do my bidding and attack the sanctuary cities, then you're either going to need to resign from us or you're going to be terminated. And so that's what you see going on. And I imagine that playbook and that play is not going to be just limited to the Department of Justice, but you're going to see that happen throughout the federal bureaucracy as it relates to targeting people who he feels are not in line with this program.
That was Attorney Adante Poynter of Lawyers for the People, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. Everybody knows that they're guilty. Everybody knows that they lied. Everybody knows that they're guilty. Resting on their conscience, eating their inside. It's freedom. Said it's freedom time now. It's freedom. Said it's freedom time now. Time to get free. Oh, give yourselves up now. It's freedom. Said it's freedom time. Yo, there's a war in the mind over territory for the dominion. Who will dominate the opinions, schisms and isms, keeping us in forms of religion, conforming our vision to the world church's decision, trapped in a section, submitted to committee election, moral infection, epidemic lies and deception, insurrection of the highest possible order, distort, and I take recorders from hearing like underwater, beyond the borders, find ascending disorder, bound by the strategy of systemic depravity, heavy as gravity, head first in the cavity, without a bottom, a fate worse than Sodom. What's got them drunk off the spirits? Truth comes, we can't hear it when you've been programmed to fear it. I had a vision, I was falling in indecision, appalling, calling religious a program on television. How can dominant wisdom be recognized in a system of antichrists and majority rules, intelligent fools? PhD's an illusion, master's a mass confusion, bachelor's a past delusion. Now who you choosing? The head of the tail, the bloodshed of the male, or confidence in the veil? Conferences at Yale discussing doctrines of bail, causing people to fail, keeping the third in jail. His word is nailed, everything to the tree, severing all of me from all that I used to be. Formless and void, totally paranoid, enjoy darkness as Lord, keeping me from the sword. Blocked from mercy, bitter than Circe, hungry and thirsty for good meat we would eat. That was Lauryn Hill, Freedom Time. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasiliev. Last week was the second anniversary of the Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, and their ignition of hundreds of tons of toxic material. Vice President J.D. Vance, who had visited with the residents before becoming vice president, came to the town for a press conference but did not meet with any of the residents who have been sickened. Vance said that he was against any emergency proclamation that would provide the residents with health care and funds to move out of their contaminated homes. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer was in East Palestine for the second year anniversary, where residents held a press conference and spoke out about their nightmare.
Is there any supervision of the cleanup?
So far, I know after Norfolk stopped their remediation, they were going with CERCLA. So they're just continuing with what the EPA had arranged.
So when they do the cleanup, people are getting sick during the cleanup.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Have you another?
If you would stand here and watch a truck go by, you'll start to feel it. You'll smell the truck. I mean, it's still bad. We're still sick. We're still suffering. People don't want the ridicule and problems that go along with speaking their mind and having those issues. So no one should have that. We just want to go back to living a normal life, and we can't do that without the help of Vance, Trump, our representatives. I mean, I'm bipartisan, but anyone would help anyone. If you see a car on fire, your thought is to help them, not to ask them what political party they're with. You just help them.
When Biden came to town, all I heard was a pledge to spend millions in NIH grants to prestigious universities to study us. I think that is the most ridiculous insult I could think of.
Yes,
where is the people getting out of this poison? Where's the health care? You don't care about the people who just want to study us like guinea pigs.
You can see who are getting jobs from this. You know, people in the fire department, their family members working for Norfolk Southern, you know, other family members getting jobs, you know, at the fire department. Those are the people that are speaking to our vice president today, not the people that you're hearing from here that are suffering. You know, I honestly believe that our local government has been very openly bought out. Not everybody believes that. You know, some people think let's get what we can get and, you know, while we can get it. And that's fine. But there's some of us that are more worried about our health. What's a $25 million park gonna do if your kid has cancer and can't go over there to play?
Please know that once you get to the point where you need health care because you have some serious illness, it's too late. Because we know what cancer does to people, what the survival rate is, and especially what these chemicals, the type of cancers that it causes, it's very scary. So that's why I think it's important to get people away from the thing that causes the damage before it's too late.
And already too late.
And they ignited
the constant exposure. We are constantly re-exposed.
I don't want to treat my cancer. I don't want to get cancer in the first place. It's no fun being treated for cancer. They didn't say they could fix you and cure you. They know how to treat it, not cure it.
The CDC came in and got sick and left.
Since this train derailment, that very first season, our kids, our goats, we lost 6 kids. And I have found aborted goat fetus in my pasture. And I have not had, well, even this year, we had 3 kids. One died right at birth. Our second doe, she had 2 kids. She died shortly after birth. The first little kid died, and about 3 months later, the second kid died. We have not had surviving goat kids since this train derailment, and we lost 1 cow.
There was also just a lawsuit about a dog kennel, several kennels, that have lost like 112 or 116 puppies, and a lot of them have been born with deformities, and the ones that did survive all have issues with their liver enzymes. And animals are a precursor to human health because they age faster. You see these types of illnesses in animals before you start seeing it in humans.
Sarah Zarling, I'm a rail safety advocate with Citizens Acting for Rail Safety in Watertown, Wisconsin. I'm here in support of the citizens of East Palestine and everybody who's been affected by this derailment.
And I understand there have been over 1,500 derailments since East Palestine. What does that tell you about the danger to communities all over the United States with railroads and toxins and the danger of another East Palestine taking place?
Right. You'll have to forgive me for not knowing that exact figure. I do know that there are a lot of derailments. There are derailments that happen every day. Even from, you know, relatively minor ones, but there are still a lot happening every day. The biggest point is that, yes, rail safety has not been a priority in this country. This is actually the 10th anniversary of when I became a rail safety advocate. In February of 2015, I saw an oil train go by my home. I went home and I researched what that was. I learned about the town in Quebec, Lac-Mégantic, where 47 people were incinerated off the face of the planet along with a big chunk of their town. And so that's all it took for me to know that that was unacceptable. And so that's when I became a rail safety advocate, and nothing has changed in the 10 years that I've been doing this work. There's been no rail safety legislation that has been passed. Not since 2015 was the Crude by Rail Safety Act. Nothing ever happened with that. And then J.D. Vance actually helped to draft the Railway Safety Act of 2023, which nothing has come from that as well. So the people of East Palestine, they want to make sure that their voices are heard with J.D. Vance today, because it's very important that they know that he's here for the people and not just as PR to come and meet with elected officials and selected business leader or business owners, that he's really here for the people to make sure that justice is finally done, which honestly, there can be no justice that can ever be done for the people of East Palestine.
That was Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer bringing us voices of East Palestine residents who were poisoned and contaminated by the Norfolk Southern train derailment 2 years ago and are still waiting for justice, health care, and funds to move out of contaminated homes. Last month, a massive lithium iron battery fire took place at Moss Landing in California. The first responders and residents were unprepared for the toxic hydrogen fluoride cloud that covered large parts of the area. Researcher and community activist Donna Gilmore has done a deep dive and discovered that there are major design flaws in the construction of these batteries that create fire risk. She spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
So I moved to Monterey, fresh air, Monterey Peninsula, water on three sides. All the nuclear reactors are at least 125, 150 miles away. So I'm here and managed to get a house with a view of Monterey Bay, which amazed me I could get that. And I'm looking over the bay. This is in 2019. And I'm seeing a fire, a fire across the bay at Moss Landing. What the heck is this, you know? So then I had to do a deep dive in battery storage systems, you know? I assumed they were safe and everything. I hadn't looked into it. I was focused on the nuclear stuff. And what I learned about the battery storage systems, that they have them on the PG&E grid here, is there are numerous factory defects for making lithium-ion batteries that they can't find. So there is no way that they can ever say that they can make these battery storage systems safe. And the Vistra fire, which is the battery storage system that caught on fire this time, this is the third fire they've had. And then there was one, a Tesla battery storage fire at the same location. So basically, there's been four fires in 5 years. These are new systems. And this time, it was over 100,000 batteries caught on fire. And you can't put those fires out. You just have to let them burn. So I'm seeing all this smoke, and I'm going, what's in that smoke? So I researched what's in a battery storage fire. And my goodness, there's all kinds of toxic stuff. One in particular, hydrogen fluoride. Hydrogen fluoride gas will go through your skin, go into your lungs, go into your eyes, go into your bloodstream, gets into your bloodstream. It can go to all your vital organs. This is not stuff you want to be breathing. And so the EPA came out and it did a little measuring of hydrogen fluoride. And they said, well, it's within approved levels. So there's a Facebook page with over 3,000 people talking about all the symptoms that they've been having, burning eyes, going to the hospital, having trouble breathing, all kinds of things. And the company Vistra claiming that they can make battery storage safe. The words they use is basically as safe as the, you know, whatever the current technology is. So that's a little qualifier to lie, but not lie. So there, like I said, there are numerous things that can go wrong with these batteries that are undetectable, that they have no way to stop. And these are common things that cause these battery fires. There was also a battery fire this year in San Diego County, where they just put a system in there. I forget whether it was just last year or this year. That's already caught on fire. The Tesla one, it caught on fire shortly after. So this is just not ready for prime time. But no one in any interviews they've done with anybody has mentioned that they have no way to stop these fires from these manufacturing defects and a few other things that they can't stop. Nobody is bringing that issue up. So that's the issue I want out there. It is impossible for them to make these battery storage systems safe. And it's a major health risk.
So the agencies that are supposed to do oversight on these toxins, EPA, on health and safety, OSHA, California State Department of Toxins, where are they and what reports are they making? Are they doing any surveys of the health effects for the workers and the people that live in those communities?
Well, I just want to mention one thing. You need a respirator to be protected, to protect your lungs from that hydrogen fluoride, a respirator. N95 won't work, okay? The firemen were over there without any gear on, and even there's special clothes you're supposed to wear for that. So it's crazy. Vistra, the company that owns that facility on the PG&E grid, they promised to get an independent company to inspect. That company is the one that Palestine, Ohio, you know, the car, the train that exploded. It's the same company that said everything was safe there. So, and the governor calls the shots, and the California Energy Commission, the California Public Utility Commission, he controls all of those. So it's really up to the governor to make the call, and all the elected officials, they're all of one party, and they have to go along with the governor. The APA and the toxic groups, I don't see other than the EPA out there. They said the EPA spokesperson said they were talking to the California, I forget the agency name, toxic folks, and they're the ones that talked about it being in safe levels. And I don't see anything coming from the state of California. The county supervisors, Monterey County supervisors, after four fires in 5 years, they're kind of getting the fact that this isn't safe. It's not being safely managed. And I'm just trying to bring in the fact that they can't safely manage it.
They're talking about building these battery factories all over the United States.
They're already doing them all over the state. I don't have the number of how many they have, but there's lots of them all over. And they want to put them in Santa Cruz. They want to put them at Morro Bay. And they want to put another one in San Diego County. They're just wanting them all over the place and ignoring these critical issues of the health risks and the fact they're not, you can't adequately inspect them. And all it takes is one of those batteries to have what they call a runaway, and it can set
reaction.
All the others on fire. What is it called?
Chain. So you're saying the fact that they don't know where these fires start, what batteries, and they don't have a way of protecting people. Should these plants be shut down?
They're not ready for prime time. There's no way we should have battery storage fires. I mean, there's been lithium battery fires with the electric bicycles and other things like that, but you're talking about a smaller number. But when you put stacks and stacks of lithium batteries together, you've just improved your odds that you're going to get some of the batteries that have the defects, since they can't find them at the manufacturer, they can't find them afterwards, and then some of the corrosion can happen even later, and you can't detect. This is being covered up. The people that push the batteries, I've actually talked to some of the people that other people look up to as their experts, and I say, well, I've been reading about these manufacturing defects that they have no way to find in the batteries. And the answer I get is, well, yeah, but, you know, there's new technology coming on, you know, the market. That's an okay reason to blow $1 billion this month on a battery storage system, burning 100,000 batteries and polluting the ocean, the sea otters. This is supposed to be a sanctuary for the animals and for the people. And also in this area produces like 80% of the produce for the entire country. And so are the strawberries and the other fruits and vegetables here, are they contaminated with this hydrogen fluoride and other things? Nobody's checking that I know.
That was Monterey researcher and community activist Donna Gilmore speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Right now, if some Congolese brothers walked up to you, they look just like you. Don't think you don't look Congolese. You look as much Congolese as a Congolese does. How would you feel if one of them walked up to you and asked you about what your government is doing in the Congo? I was asked that when I was over there. They take these hired killers, put them in American planes with American bombs and drop them on African villages, and you black people sitting over here cool like it doesn't even involve you.
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev, and that was the voice of Malcolm X, featured in a new documentary titled Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. The film looks at the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Johan Grimond-Prez, the filmmaker behind Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, spoke to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio.
Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to do a film about Patrice Lumumba? I know that you are from Belgium, which was the colonial master of the Congo. What motivated you politically to do this film?
Well, of course, indeed, you know, it's the ignorance. Having been raised in a country that didn't learn about this story, but although my country is so tied into the Congo and in its history, you know, I always laugh with the fact that, you know, United States is a young country behaving like a teenager, but Belgium is younger than the United States, and we're behaving like a toddler. And the history of our country is so tied into Congo as well, of course, right? Our second king, it was his private personal property. And going to school, we didn't learn all about what was really underneath going on. And it's still that seeps into the country. If you walk through Brussels, of all the big avenues and the Palais de Justice and the Royal Palace, it's all built with the rubber money. All that stuff has seeped into the ground and it's sort of not acknowledged. It's wiped under the carpet. And the previous film that I made, Shadow World, was on the global arms trade, of which, of course, the United States is very much involved in. It reels and deals half of combined of what the world actually sells and reels and deals. But I wanted to sort of dig back into the sort of how, you know, my country was involved in all this sort of global South politics and everything. Sort of setting forward, I knew about, for example, the incident during the 15th General Assembly when Nikita Khrushchev was banging his shoe on the desk. I knew about that. I had made a previous film where there was the standoff between Khrushchev and Kennedy, and Khrushchev sort of was embodied as a Hitchcock double gun in a film I made called Double Take. But I knew about the shoe. But what I did not know, that shoe actually was because of how my country was dealing with the Congo. And it's a sad story. And it's sort of what I feel in that pivotal moment of 1960s, when this huge independence wave of the continent of Africa inspired also the civil rights movement, but it caused a huge global shift within the United Nations General Assembly as well, where suddenly the Global South held the majority vote and freaked out East and West. And my country was pivotal in smashing down that sense of hope that was rising up from the non-alignment movement. And they took on assassination of Patrice Lumumba as the ground zero for like how they're going to deal in a neo-colonial move, how they were about to deal with the riches of that continent. And it's exponentially worse. It hasn't changed, actually.
Well, I was going to ask you, in looking at the genocide that's going on in the Congo right now, and I thought it was very interesting how you intertwined the politics of jazz. That was the contemporary cultural movement at the time in the United States. Whereas right now, hip hop is that same cultural movement that the Democratic Party actually tried to use and lost. But one of the dynamic things that I saw about your film is that you showed people who were actually for U.S. interests in the jazz world, such as Louis Armstrong. And then you also showed people who were adamantly against the state's interests, people like Abby Lincoln and Max Roach. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about why you intertwined such a political event and you intertwined it with the cultural movement of the time? Why? What did you see between those two things?
Like, researching that period, I could not but sort of stumble onto how music was part of that sort of historical moment. And, you know, you have to know Abby Lincoln and Max Roach, but it's mainly Abby Lincoln with the Women's Rider Coalition in Harlem with Maya Angelou and Rosa Guy. And they were calling for a protest, calling all women to sort of call protest and crash the Security Council. This was at Louis Michaud bookstore, 125th and 7th Avenue in Harlem. And it's actually a musician that initiated that protest. And what happened is that when Ian Stevenson, the then U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, in his maiden speech actually announced that Patrice Lumumba was murdered in the Congo, they sort of stood up and rioted in the Security Council. It was amazing. They got 60 tickets from the Cuban mission. And it was musicians initiating that protest. They started screaming and standing up and kept on standing. And then there was a riot ensuing. And then the security guards had to throw them out. It interrupted the whole like Security Council. But there were more musicians there as well. Paul Robeson was present. Amiri Baraka was outside protesting as well. And it's musicians. It's remarkable that it's actually musicians that initiated the protest. I think also what was going on, there was sort of a stronger Pan-African link that with the independence movement, you know, that's also embodied by Malcolm X in the film, that the fact that 16 African countries, we're talking about September 1960, the Abby Lincoln and Max Roach and Maya Angelou protest was actually the extended version of the 15th General Assembly. Sometimes resolutions are being discussed and then ratified, and it takes sometimes several months before actually the General Assembly is sort of closed off. And so the 15th General Assembly was remarkable because 16 African countries were admitted to the General Assembly, which caused sort of a political earthquake. It caused that suddenly the Afro-Asian bloc gained a majority vote. And so that threatened East and West. You know, both Khrushchev and Eisenhower were trying to play on the Global South to take them into their camp. And so Khrushchev would, at that moment, initiate a decolonization resolution, 1514. But what the United States would do is basically sending arm twisters, we can get back to that as well, but also sending black jazz ambassadors to win the hearts and minds of the Global South. And so in that situation, Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington, Nina Simone later on as well, and Louis Armstrong were sent, you know, to sort of propagate democracy, but it's very schizophrenic. You know, at one point in the film, Dizzy Gillespie says, you know, I didn't go over there to sugarcoat segregation back home, you know, were schizophrenic. They were sent out to defend democracy. But back home, they were second-rate citizens. They were not even allowed to vote. And on top of that, because you have the U.S. State Department sending, it's, you know, we have the two Dulles brothers, right? So you have the U.S. Secretary of State, Foster Dulles, steering. Even at one point, Dave Brubeck was in Syria in 1958. He actually prolonged his stay because he was afraid of Abdel Nasser, sort of with his Pan-Arab Union, you know, making one country of Syria and Egypt, the United Arab Republic. And so Foster Dulles freaked out and sent Dave Brubeck to Syria. So those jazz ambassadors were used as sort of pieces in a chess game of a global politics. And so when Louis Armstrong is sent out, or Dizzy Gillespie, for example, is sent out to Syria in 1956, Operation Straggler is happening, where the other Dulles brother, Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, is plotting to overthrow the Syrian government. And so with Louis Armstrong, it's very similar. Louis Armstrong is sent into the Congo, third week of October and third week of November, but it's in the middle of how my country, in cahoots with the CIA, with Larry Devon was the head of the CIA based in the Congo, but also with Alan Dulles. And they were trying to get the United States on their cause by labeling Patrice Lumumba as a communist, but he was not at all. The film starts with the fact of him saying, you know, I'm not a communist, I'm actually an African. But it was a way for the Belgians to get the Americans, the US, United States on their cause. And so you see while Louis Armstrong is arriving in the Congo, they're plotting the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And he's the first democratically elected premier. But what Malcolm X says is that, you know, it's not communism or socialism they're afraid of. It's Africanism. It's people standing up for their own right and choosing that the riches of the country would benefit the population. And so that was threatening for the Belgians, you know. It put the resources of the Union Minière d'Haut-Katanga, which was Leopold II's company, in jeopardy, you know. And it's still exponentially worse today. It's still the same companies. You know, when the political facts came out with the Parliamentary Commission in 2003, 2004 in Belgium, following the book and the publication of Ludo de Wet's book, The Assassination of Patrice Lumumba, Union Minière changed the name in UBICOR, but they're still, you know, involved in the area. And you have the private militias, M23, you know, backed up by the Rwanda leader. And what is used is actually rape as a tool of war to empty the villages to get at the conflict minerals. But we were talking about the music, right? So it's not because Louis Armstrong was sent out as sort of a tool, a political tool, that doesn't mean he was a passive instrument. He very much had his own agency. And, you know, at one point during the African tour, he refused to go to play for the apartheid's audience in South Africa. Or when he would go over to Katanga, people are aware of the film, but Katanga, there was a secessionist sort of movement that was propped up by the Union Minière, the mining company, where they had a Marinette president who was hosting Louis Armstrong. But Louis Armstrong was very much, if you hear Tommy Trombone, the trombonist of the All-Stars, which were playing with Louis Armstrong, he sort of said, you know, well, they send us out there in Katanga, but it was a hot zone, right? Because Moshe Tshombe that was plotting together with Mobutu to assassinate Patrice Lumumba. But, you know, Tommy Trombone is literally saying, you know, we were all like siding with Lumumba. And so at the moment when Louis Armstrong was lodged at the villa with Moshe Tshombe, he was grilling Moshe Tshombe and said, you're in bed with big money. You're in bed with big money. You know, even with Little Rock as well, you know, Louis Armstrong was, you know, he's always been labeled as an Uncle Tom, but actually he was very outspoken during Little Rock when the sort of halting blew open about segregation. He literally, for as being a black jazz ambassador, refused to go play in Russia. And labeled the government, you know, very hypocritical. Even, you know, the government go to hell was a quote from the New York Times that actually he uttered. So he's very outspoken, but you have to know even 1960, 1961, his concerts were still being bombed by white supremacists. Huh? There's a Knoxville concert that was bombed because he was playing with a mixed band. So he had to navigate many things, but Lucille, his wife, we have a little short bit of interview in the film, where she actually says, you know, well, Louis Armstrong was very upset. Even when he came back from the African tour and learned about Patrice Lumumba's murder, he was so upset that he threatened to resign and, you know, resign his American citizenship and move to Ghana.
Right. I saw that. I've never seen that footage before. But another important thing that I thought was very important was that you talked about the politics of the time and the revolutionary politics of the time, but you also showed the confluence of not just the Pan-African movement, but the Asian movement, what was going on in Latin America. You had people such as Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Nehru, Sukarno, Castro, Mao Zedong, all of them were included in the film. What were you trying to bring out by showing the confluence of these revolutionary leaders?
Well, you know, there was that big change with all these countries becoming independent that, in a sense, they were banded together in the non-alignment movement away from East and West and said, you know, it's time to up to the global South to set its own course, and even declaring colonialism obsolete. That was the Bandung sort of statement as well, 1955, which was organized by Sukarno in Indonesia, inviting all the non-aligned leaders amongst, yes, Jawaharlal Nehru, Abdel Nasser was there. There was a Ghani's delegation from Guinea. There was also Zhou Enlai, who was the premier of China. And they all together for a week were hanging out, and like 5 days hanging out and sort of setting course of how to really, you know, make a statement that declared colonialism obsolete. The Global South was growing in sort of in scope as well. And I went back a little bit in the beginning of the film to actually take on that non-alignment movement, because these were precisely all the leaders that made it to the United Nations General Assembly in 1960. But the big absentee in September 1960 is Patrice Lumumba. We have all these leaders there, but he was the one who refused the visa by the U.S. Ambassador Timberlake in Leopoldville. And subsequently also the Dag Hammarskjöld, who officially said, yeah, let's do this. But then unofficially, he was actually complicit with sort of the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba. He had his back against the wall. The United States and the United Kingdom were threatening to withdraw the finances to the UN mission. And then he had the slalom between, you know, what the West wanted and then what Abdel Nasser and Kwame Nkrumah saying, you know, we threatened to withdraw our UN troops. We don't agree with sort of what you've done with closing down the airport and the radio and sort of being complicit with the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba. They were very upset. And so the 15th General Assembly was for a big part about that Congo crisis. But you have to know that prior to the 15th General Assembly, which is called the Year of Africa, by the way, in the United Nations, because 16 African countries were admitted. But it's the moment where Nikita Khrushchev set sail literally on the boat to the United Nations, inviting all world leaders, which was a precedent. Before, world leaders did not make it to the General Assembly, it was more the representatives. But here for the first time, and even the first time that all those non-aligned leaders were banding together in New York. But ironically, what happens is that at one point, Fidel Castro, for example, still the first sort of speech of Fidel Castro, which is still the marathon speech, which is still the longest speech in history of the United Nations, he was thrown out of his hotel. And so Malcolm X invited him to his headquarters at the Hotel Therese in Harlem. And unwittingly, you know, there was suddenly a Bandung top happening in Harlem, where Jawaharlal Nehru visited Fidel Castro in the Hotel Teresa. Abdel Nasser came over and there was a huge talk of 90 minutes on the sidewalk in front of Hotel Teresa. And people were banding together and suddenly Harlem was in the spotlight of the world. And it's also the first time where Nikita Khrushchev really making a statement to say we had to point out we didn't agree with America's U.S. policies towards sort of the blacks, but also the Cuban delegation. And Nikita Khrushchev made a decision to sort of say hello. He was the first one to go over actually to Hotel Teresa. And with his limousine, he's arriving on 21st Street and 7th Avenue. And it's for the first time Fidel Castro and Nikita Khrushchev were hugging each other. And suing into that, you have to know that he also proposed the decolonization resolution 1514, which was then taken up by the Global South. Not to say that he's a saint, I think, but I think it's interesting to still hear a story of that moment from the point of view of the villain, that he literally didn't say, we're going to bury you, as Dizzy Gillespie is laughing. And, you know, he's laughing about that. He didn't say, we're going to bury you. He said, we're going to bury colonialism, which is a very different statement that was mistranslated. And so if Dizzy is joking about it, that it was mistranslated, he was right on the ball.
And last but not least, can you talk a little bit about the connections that you see in today's world? I mean, there's no Nikita Khrushchev, there's Putin, there's no Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré, there is the Sahel Alliance, and there's BRICS. Mm-hmm. Do you see any connection to what I'm calling African independence, or I should say really world independence 2.0?
Well, maybe it should be 3.0. You know, like Cabral also already said, this time for a second independence movement, you know, because after the killing and assassination of Patrice Lumumba, what happened? The whole country was an upheaval, and two-thirds of the country was siding as rebels with Patrice Lumumba. And Jorge Gonzalo Natalia, the Congolese scholar, wrote about it in inspiration to Cabral, that that was the second independence movement. But I think when you hear the scream at the end of the film, Abby Lincoln screaming out of anger, it means that actually she didn't agree with what was going on. And that anger has seeped into the ground, I think, when you think about the Global South. And it's true, things are in upheaval again and are moving a bit. And the Global South is sort of like, after those 60 years, you know, that anger has sort of is embodied, it's domesticated. It's sort of something that is ready to explode. And yeah, we can talk about the new Cold War as well. But, you know, I think there's a lot of misinformation about what Putin is all about as well in Ukraine, because I wouldn't say George Bush Jr. was a saint as well. They're worth each other, you know, like back and forth between East and West. You know, it's always easy to point the finger outside and make a common enemy outside, to sort of not to have to look at all the issues inside the country. What I've analyzed in a previous film, what I would call the corporatocracy, is that, and Chris Hedges labels it, a corporate coup d'etat. In essence, that you have three defense lobbyists, we could call them war lobbyists, but there's three defense lobbyists for corporate defense lobbyists for every politician in Washington. And so I think while, yes, there is that sort of anger and upsetness and things moving in the Global South and worldwide, but there's also something called, you know, Michael Hart calls it global apartheid. It's not that sometimes those walls are not just merely physical, like, you know, Mexican wall or a Gaza wall or you name it. It's also domesticated inside. It's something more intimate, that actually our minds have been colonized, you know. But I don't know if you've seen Shadow World. It's very much also, Vijay Prashad is one of the narrators in the film, where say that dream had to be smashed. And it's the World Bank and the World Economic Forum and sort of this big institutions that actually were holding the Global South in check. You know, the World Bank is merely that. It's giving a loan and then it's all slouched back to corporations in the West. And then they hold a knife on the throat of the country to say, you know, well, then you give us this and that and that and that. And I think it's time for a big shift, you know. But
do you see BRICS being that? Do you see BRICS offering an alternative to that outside of the U.S. dominating that, you know, having an economic hegemony on how business is handled in the world?
Yes, but, you know, we have to keep those questioning those things, you know. What I feel that what potentially be a solution is participatory budgeting. And let me explain. Participatory budgeting is now again, $8 billion is given to Israel. But if you would have participatory budgeting, for example, in the United States, it happens in Brazil, in Recife, in the city of Recife, they have participatory budgeting. What does that mean is that a percentage of the tax is being decided by the people. And so they demand hospitals, playgrounds in the poor neighborhoods, and suddenly a percentage of the tax money goes to what's really needed. Like, if you know that 60 cents of every American tax dollar goes to war, it's nuts. But if you would have participatory budgeting, that would mean that if everybody can decide about their tax money, they would refuse to give it to sort of a war in Ukraine or a war in Gaza. That in itself would already be something quite important. And I'm a bit skeptical about sort of big institutions than the BRIC again, that actually it all happens above their head. But I think it's time that actually people have a participatory say. And you don't have to be economic genius to decide that actually in your neighborhood you need a playground and not sort of drug dealing or something. But, you know, of course, this is a longer discussion, and Soundtrack to Coup d'Etat only sort of tips at a template that is actually out there. But of course, you have the iPhone commercial and the Tesla commercial, and you have the statistics that follow that and says, you know, well, the template that you see in the film is that it hasn't disappeared. And so maybe, yeah, the BRICS can sort of, maybe the power can change hands, but still we have to be very critical still that actually goes down and benefits the people. That's always the thing. That's always the big question.
No doubt. Well, I would just to add on to that, you know, BRICS may be too big of a thing, but hopefully the Sahel Alliance can take the role of what Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and the original OAU crew was trying to set up.
Yeah, and it's funny that the film came out when actually the whole thing in Nigeria, and then they were drawing out the CIA and the French and sort of saying, you know, enough of it, you know, it's time that we can actually control our own country, because, you know, the biggest export of the United States is coup d'etat.
That was Johan Grimond-Prez, director of Soundtrack to a Coup d'etat, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. You can hear more from JR at blockreportradioworld.com. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and J.R. Valray. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button and follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.